Listening Dog Media. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Chris Hawkins, and this is How to DJ.
I think radio is one of your first freedoms in the fact that you finally can make choices of your own musically, what you're going to listen to.
The early days, the first year in XFM was the most fun, the most, I can't believe we're getting away with it. Oh no, hang on, we haven't got away with it.
I'm getting to do exciting stuff, and I feel like the show is evolving all the time.
Podcast exploring life stories, techniques, minds, and experiences of much-loved DJs, where I ask them to pick five questions from a box of 45. And for this episode, a Radio 1 DJ.
I felt really great that I was, like, you know, respected enough at Radio 1 now to be in charge.
A mental health ambassador.
That is so random. Why the hell have I trained to be a counsellor? Like, I'm not even intending to go into it as a job. Like, why did I do that?
An adored kids TV presenter turned adored grown-up TV presenter.
Great, the best, just the best job in the world, honestly. I would have done it forever.
Katie Thistleton, welcome to How to DJ.
Oh, what a lovely intro.
Amazing that, though, isn't it? What about that? That's you.
That's really nice. Oh, it's so good to be finally doing this. We've talked about it for ages.
I know. Did you listen to a lot of radio as a kid?
Yeah. Do you know what? My early memories of radio, maybe not as a kid, more of a teenager. I feel like I don't really remember it much as a kid. I feel like I remember my mum and dad's music as a kid, but they probably were playing, I was going to say CDs, but it'll have been cassettes, wasn't it? My early memories of radio, I think, were going to school in the car and all of a sudden taking over and going, actually, sorry, mum, we're putting Capital on, you know, we're putting, well, it was Galaxy then, we're putting Galaxy on, we're putting Q103 on because I want my music on. And those were the two stations that I listened to. So I listened to loads of Rob Reich and Wingman and loads of Mike and Chelsea. And do you know, I had a specific memory of being a teenager in the car and listening to them and thinking, how do radio DJs have friends, families, partners? Because they farm out their loved ones for material all the time. And they're so honest. And they'll talk about they've had a row with their girlfriend or they've, you know, some their mum's done something stupid. And I used to think, God, as such a people pleaser person, I used to think, how do they not fall out with everyone? And I think about that early memory all the time now when I'm like texting my family or my friends or my husband and going, sorry, I've told this story. Is that all right? And they're like, well, it's too late now. You've told it to millions of people.
Where did you grow up?
Manchester. So Ashton-under-Lyne is where I was born, in sort of like East Manchester.
And went to school?
Yeah, went to school in Drawlsden, which was the neighbouring town to there.
What was school like?
Good, yeah. Went to an all-girls school.
Is that good?
Yeah, it was good. I remember my mum just being like, you're not going to a mixed school. The boys will just distract you, and sent me to this all-girls school. And suppose you just, people are often fascinated by that, but you don't know any different if you go to a same-sex school. Was yours same-sex or mixed?
Mixed.
Mixed, yeah. So but what was funny about it was I think we were like goofier. So I think that's where my kind of like love for like the kind of stupid stuff that I ended up doing on kids' TV probably came about.
Yeah.
When I became a kids' TV presenter, my old form tutor got in touch with me and he was like, of course this is what you're doing. Because every lunchtime we would like do little sketches or we'd make up dance routines or like, I always tell this story, but once like I dropped a Mars bar and like I opened my Mars bar about to eat it, dropped it immediately on the floor, was devastated. So we gave it a funeral. Like we just did really, we were just stupid. And I think if boys had been there, we wouldn't have been as goofy. We messed about more.
Uninhibited.
But yeah, I think so. But also not completely because there was still, you know, a lot of bullying. There was still so much pressure to look a certain way. Like, it wasn't like we weren't bothered about what we looked like. We used to still like pile all the makeup on and like, yeah, have the short skirts on. And that pressure was still there from the other girls, of course. But I think we were a bit more goofy. But I also think now that I've seen my nieces and nephews grow up and them having been to a mixed school, I think I didn't ever see boys as mates. I thought boys were boyfriends, but I don't think I knew you could have like platonic relationships with boys.
What difference would that make?
I think probably not until I got into the working world did I think I had any like lad mates. I think I thought that like lads were for going out with and girls were for mates. And then now I've got loads of mates, the platonic like male friendships. But what I notice in my nieces and nephews is they're so young, they're like 18, but they'll hang around with someone of the opposite sex and go out with them all the time, but there's nothing going on there. And I'm like, oh, and I'm like, oh, what's going on then? And they're like, no, we're just mates. And I'm like, really? Surely not.
Who was your first boyfriend?
My first proper boyfriend I went out with for 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What happened?
What happened to why we broke up?
Yeah.
We got together too young, you know, and we were very different. Very, very different.
Well, your life...
It was a sort of college thing that went on too long.
Your life, it sounds so textbook, your road to doing kids' TV.
Yeah.
Was it, do you think?
No, not at all, because I didn't want to do it. It wasn't something I wanted to do. Now I look back and I think, God, kids' TV makes so much sense from what I just described to you, because I was always silly and I loved kids' stuff. And radio makes so much sense because my one overriding quality when I was younger is that I never shut up talking. And I was desperate to tell stories and I was desperate to just pass information on that I'd learn. But I never wanted to do those things. I wanted to be a writer when I was little. I think like the only thing I was really good at was English. I was like, that was a subject I excelled at. And one of my teachers was like, oh, you're great at writing stories. So I went, all right, I'll be a writer one day, you know. And then I remember sort of just convincing myself from that age on, right, that's what I'll be. And then one of my uncles said to me, like, you can't make much money being a writer unless you're like J.K. Rowling. And I was like, oh, okay. And I remember thinking, well, how can I write every day and get paid a salary? Like, this is what, like, you know, me as a seven-year-old was like. And I thought, oh, I'll be a journalist. I'll write for newspapers and magazines and stuff. And I just set off down that route. And that's what I was convinced I would do. And I did an English degree. And then I did an NCTJ, which is like the year sort of fast track journalism qualification. And while I was doing that, I guess like local papers were dying out a little bit. The phone hacking scandal was all in the news. It just didn't feel exciting to be in newspapers. But I'd started to get work experience in newsrooms at community radio stations. And that felt really exciting. And I was like, oh my God, broadcasting's where it's at. I'm going to be a broadcast journalist or I'm going to be a producer that produces these shows. But never did I think I'd be a presenter.
It was Salford University, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. How was that time?
Great. I lived at home because I'm such a home bird. I literally went to Salford Uni and lived at home because I was too much of a wimp to go and like move away. And there's a little bit of me that sort of wishes I had like moved away, like gone away somewhere at uni, but it was just what was right for me at the time. Like I had this boyfriend, I, you know, had my group of friends. I'm really stressed about hygiene. I wouldn't have coped very well living in student accommodation. I had a couple of jobs. I've always been like just such a workaholic. So at that time I was working at Argos, where I worked from being 16 to about 21. And I also was working for the NHS in like an admin role because my mum worked there. So I was just like, no, I don't want to give up my jobs and, you know, my friendships and sort of move away. So yeah, so uni was fun, but I don't feel like uni was my lifestyle. Like I was going out around that time, but I was going out with the people I worked with at Argos and the people I went to school with. Uni was like, right, go and get your qualification. And, you know, I was always just like, right, get this and get that job in the BBC.
So were you going to be a journalist?
Yeah, I wanted to be a journalist, broadcast journalist. And then I suppose when I started to like learn how the BBC worked, I did some work experience when I was just finishing my NCTJ with radio drama over at Oxford Road at the BBC there. And so then I learned about researchers and assistant producers and producers and that they're basically journalists. You know, it's a creative role where you make these broadcast programmes. I was like, right, that's what I want to do. I want to get into the BBC and I want to work my way up that rank behind the scenes. And so that's what I kind of started to do. I got a job on the talent pool, BBC talent pool for production management assistants. so basically, like, you'd be on this pool for a year and they'd ring you up when they had a job. And I got 3 months working for radio drama. I'd done my work experience as a PMA, which for people who don't know is production management assistant. You know, it's an admin role, quite a junior admin role. I guess it's kind of like a runner, but you're doing all the bookings, you know, you're booking the taxis, the trains, the studios, all that. I did that. And then I did it in Birmingham for 6 months. I got a job there and I worked in Birmingham on like Farming Today and all the like the Archers, all those like rural farmy programs, which is not a world I'm from. I'm very much a city girl. And while I was there, I applied for a job as a PA in CBBC and CBeebies. So the secretary to the head of CBBC and head of CBeebies. And I got that job. And then that's how I ended up at Children's.
Well, how though? How did that turn into being on screen?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So I did this job and I remember everyone going to me, oh, don't get stuck being a PA. You'll never get into a creative job again. And I was like, that, you know, put the fear into me because I loved this job because bosses I worked for, Damien Kavanagh, who was head of CBBC, Kay Bembo's head of CBeebies, and then Cheryl Taylor, who took over as head of CBBC, just the best people to work for. Learned so much in that role because I was working with proper adults, you know, and I was only in my probably 22 then. And these were proper adults that, you know, is the senior people in the BBC. And I learned so much about how the BBC worked. And I was so passionate about the kids' programme. I genuinely loved what they did. So I loved that job, but it wasn't creative. It was admin based. So any opportunity to do something creative, I would. So whenever they would ask, they would need someone to be Pudsey or they would need someone to come on Blue Peter behind the scenes dressed in a stupid outfit, I would do it. And I kept doing radio shows on community radio to keep up the creativity. And what's really funny is at the time I was telling myself, I'm doing those radio shows, even though I was presenting them, I was like, I'm doing these so I can go into interviews at the BBC and say, look, I'm creative. I've come up with all these ideas for my show. But never at any point did I think, oh, I could do this on Radio 1. That's so weird to me. I honestly think I didn't have the confidence to think that that could be me. It was like my brain went, people like you aren't on Radio 1. People like you aren't on CBBC. Whoever these presenters are, the faces, they must have been to theatre school or they're a different type of person.
What kind of person do you think you were at that time?
Very bubbly and the kind of person that looking back, the bosses obviously looked at and thought she'd be good on kids' TV because they obviously saw something. Because what happened was I just got a job as a researcher for CBBC's radio. Gorgeous little job, writing little poems and stories for babies, working on a team of three, one of which I ended up marrying. So lovely little team. I thought, this is great. I'll do this forever. And then Cheryl Taylor, the boss of CBBC, we'd been over to watch Blue Peter together one day and we were walking back and we were talking about it. And she said, have you ever thought about presenting? And I was like, no. And she said, would you go for a screen test if we sent you for one? And I was like, I suppose so. And it had never even occurred to me. And then like 2 days later, the boss of the presentation department came over and said, so you booked in for Tuesday?
Had it really never occurred to you?
I swear it hadn't. But I find that bizarre because I'm like, were you stupid then? Like, how did you not? You were doing radio shows on community radio and you loved it. So how did you not go, maybe I could do this on Radio 1?
I'm very driven as well.
I was very driven behind the scenes. But there was obviously a gap in my confidence when it came to thinking I could be a performer in some sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just honestly didn't occur to me. And looking back, maybe it was a fear actually as well. Maybe it was that I thought that world seemed really scary for all the reasons that it is scary. So it honestly, I think I had thought maybe I could do the news on the radio or the telly. But I never thought, oh, I'll be that person that does the silly chat or gets gunged and pied in the face with the puppet dog. Like, it never occurred to me, even though I loved it. And I used to take guests over to studio and meet Hacker and be like, oh, this is Hacker, he's great. And I used to get screen tests into my inbox and I'd pass them on to the bosses. Oh, this girl looks good. You know, like, genuinely, I never went, how about me? And it's funny because Damien Kavanagh, who was great, and every now and again we'd like have some drinks and he'd, you know, there'd be like a load of us at some work drinks and he'd go, have you ever thought about presenting? And then before I could even answer, he'd go, no, it'll ruin your life. Don't do that, it'll ruin your life. And so he'd obviously thought about it. Cheryl had obviously thought about it. And so, yeah, she put me for a screen test and I got the gig and I was like, what the hell's going on?
And you became part of what now you can look back on and say was a golden age of CBBC presenters.
Yeah, so good.
What a lineup.
Oh, just the best time. I have so much love for CBBC and CBeebies. I will shout it from the rooftops to the day I die.
You've all done so well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was on with Ian Sterling, but he left not long after I sort of started. Obviously, he's done incredibly well. I was on with Karim Zeruel, Reese Stevenson, Lauren Layfield, of course, Hacker and Dodge. And yeah, it was a really, Yeah, really great bunch. Like, they are like family to me. You know, it was, I've met my best friends in that job. Shannon Flynn, who is like my best mate. She lives in Australia now. And she's not in the industry anymore, not at the moment anyway, because she's moved to Australia. But met her there, met my husband and children's. Like, I just met all my favourite people.
How long were you there for?
2012, I started working in the office. Was it 2011? Got the presenting job in 2013 and left in 2019. So I did the presenting for 6 years.
And a lot of it live, nearly all of it.
Yeah. Yeah, we were live every afternoon. Great, the best, just the best job in the world, honestly. I would have done it forever, but I just knew that it was time to go. But I would have done it forever.
There was some serious stuff, wasn't there, along the way, whilst getting gunged. You know, there was stuff to get your teeth into.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I was like a rabbit caught in the headlights for the first couple of years, to be honest. I had never done any performing.
So how did you adapt, do you think? Well or not?
No, not well at the start, I don't think. I don't think I was coping with it very well, actually, but I was just thrown in and just getting on with it. It's weird. I say to kids now when I go into schools and they can't fathom this, and it is unfathomable now. I'd never looked down a camera and spoken into it because we didn't do that then. But now, of course, everyone's done that. Everyone's sent a video to the mates or done an Instagram story or at least FaceTimed. But back then, you didn't do that. I'd never looked down a camera and spoken into it. I did drama at GCSE and that's about it. So all of a sudden, they were like, put this wig on, do an accent. I was like, what the hell's going on? So I don't think I did cope very well. I think I was really shell-shocked for the first couple of years. But I had great people around me and, you know, the puppeteers, Phil and Warwick, who are two of my best friends in the world. I think at first probably thought, who the hell's this? She's shit. But I eventually started to love me. I broke my way in, and having those people around me, I think, got me into it and eventually started loving it. And then I became good at it. You become good at something when you love it, you know?
Is there a difference, would you say, between loving performing and loving seeing yourself on screen?
Oh my God, yes. And I say to people who want to be an actor or, you know, want to be a presenter or whatever, like, obviously you're going to have these big dreams, everybody is, but if you enjoy the act of it, you should enjoy that if it's in front of 4 people or if it's in front of 4 million. And I think a lot of people are getting into it for the wrong reasons because they think the sort of fame element of it will bring them joy, and it will bring you anything but that. And that's why I'm still so passionate about the other side of it. Like, I would go back to producing, and I would go back to being a researcher and go down that line and be a producer in a heartbeat, because I just love what we're doing. I'm not really bothered about having to be the famous one. But once you get into it, once I got into presenting, it was like, right, well, now I've got to go down this route, you know? And then everyone tells you what your goals should be. Everyone goes, well, you should want to do Radio 1, or you should want to do Strictly, or you should want to, you know, everyone tells you, like, this should be your goal. And you're like, oh, okay, so I'll go for that. And I felt like I was just really learning that along the way. And I find it really hard when someone approaches me and goes, I want to be a presenter. I feel like I can advise them how to work really hard and get into the BBC, because I did that through hard work. But I don't really know how to relate to someone who's wanted to present since they were like a kid, because I didn't.
How do you think you adapted then?
I think it was mainly the people around me. And I think in children's, everyone's quite self-deprecating. There's not a lot of egos. It was like we all felt a bit hard done by, you know. Children's has less of a budget than other areas of TV. You know, we had somebody working in the team for a long time who was a bully, you know. I can say that they were, and they're, you know, no longer there and went a very long time ago. We all sort of trauma bonded, I think, from some of the hard times, but also we had the most fun because it is the most fun place to work. And I think the fact that pretty much everyone who worked there, bar maybe 1-2 people, were the best people in the world. And we all felt very in it together. I think that's kind of got what got me through it. But I did have a really terrible bout of depression around that. You know, it was kind of about maybe a year in. That's the first time in my life I'd ever been depressed. And that's when I first went on antidepressants.
What brought that on?
Well, I'd just broken up with that boyfriend that I'd been with 8 years. So that was probably a big thing.
I would never normally ask if it was your first boyfriend, but it's weird how significant that was.
Yeah, it is significant because, you know, it was just a big life change, you know, when you're with someone for a very long time. And also, yeah, I guess my life just changed in a lot of ways overnight because that changed. I lived with him. We had a house together. You know, we bought a house together at like 23, which, you know, was so young looking back. But I left that situation, lost a lot of friends through leaving that relationship. Met my now husband, who is the best thing in the world. So was falling in love at the same time as like going through the guilt of leaving a relationship, and also in this mad world of now being on the telly. And, you know, children's TV is quite relaxed when it comes to this kind of stuff, but you do get a bit of trolling. You know, you do get a bit of people saying stuff about you on Twitter or whatever. Yeah. And also it just feels very vulnerable. Still now, I just love radio so much more than TV. Because it's so vulnerable being on camera. I'm too insecure for it. I hate watching myself back.
Antidepressants at that age, that seems, that's severe. That's serious.
I suppose so, yeah. Yeah. And yeah, but I mean, I would have taken anything they gave me at the time to, you know, because I was in a right state. And like, I would go into CBBC and I would go in the toilets and have a little cry. And I would go in there just for 5 minutes just to not be bothered by anyone and to not have to be all jazz hands. Because I remember one day I was sat in the makeup chair and my producer came in. He's a lovely man. And he came in and he was like, hey, you okay? And I just went, hi. And he was like, are you all right? Because everyone was used to me being, you know, bouncing off the walls. And you feel this pressure to be bounced off the walls and to be the person that looks after the guests and makes sure they're having a good time. And you've got to be on. It's, you know, it's kids' TV. You've got to be happy. So I would like, and it's exhausting trying to be happy when you're not. So I would like go and have these little moments of, and then I remember thinking, I'm going to lose my job here because I'm not doing a good job and I seem like I don't want to be here. And when you go on antidepressants at the start, like, it can get worse before it gets better. You know, you get a lot of side effects. And I remember I was in a terrible state those first sort of couple of weeks when I was on them. So I remember going to one of my producers and saying to her, can I just have a word? I was like, just let you know, I've just gone on antidepressants and I'm just not feeling good at all. And she just went, oh, which ones? And then she was like, yeah, I'm on them too. And I was like, oh. And I went and spoke to my boss about it. And he was like, oh, I hope you're okay. Like, we'll look after you. Like, they were really good about it. And then I was like, oh God, right, okay. This is all right. But yeah, people always ask, I mean, I'm sure like you'll agree, like people always say, what's the hardest thing about the job? And it's like, pretend to be happy when you're not.
Yeah. Was that the start, do you think, then? I guess it was obviously the start of you learning how to protect your mental health.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I'd been already passionate about that subject. I'd always had anxiety really badly, and I knew that because I'd been diagnosed. I'd always, when I was a kid, I used to like be like, Mum, I can't breathe. And I'd be doing this, and I'd be like, I can't breathe. And she would take me for asthma tests, and they'd be like, our lungs are fine. And then she'd stop me eating Smarties, and because she'd be like, it's the food colorings, and no kid wants that. And then I remember like getting in my first job, which was for the NHS, and it was a data entry job. And they came back, and I went to the doctors, and the doctor said, oh, it's panic attacks. And it was only when I turned 17 that they said that's what it was. And I was thinking, I had this since I was like really little. So I was already quite savvy about that. And also, that data entry job for the NHS was for a mental health trust. So I would walk in every day and they'd have these stats all over the wall that like the biggest killer in men between 35 and 50 is suicide, and one in four people have a mental health problem, and one in six have an eating disorder. And those stats have all changed now. In fact, they're probably worse. And I remember walking in and being like, this is insane. And I've got a close relative who's a drug addict, and I had a close relative who took their own life when he was 20 and I was 18, a cousin of mine. So I was already... that passion was there, you know, and I felt like I already had a different view to my friends on mental health. And then when you start on Kids TV, you get a lot of charities approaching you to ask you to be an ambassador and stuff. And my boss said to me at the time, you can't do them all, so think about what you really care about. And I was like, mental health is what I care about, kids' mental health, young people's mental health. So I started doing stuff with Young Minds and Place to Be. So it all just grew from there. But then, yeah, once I experienced that depression myself, that interest, yeah, obviously peaked even more.
I guess that made you a natural presenter for Life Hacks.
Yes. So, yeah, it was actually, yeah, a friend of mine who said, why don't you speak to Radio 1 about the surgery? And again, like, honestly, maybe I'm just stupid because it never occurred to me I could do that. Actually, no, I don't think it's that I'm stupid because, like you say, I'm very ambitious. And behind the scenes, I was always going, oh, maybe I could do this job and this job. And I really wanted to climb that ladder. But I thought there's no way Radio 1 would want me. There's no way CBBC would want me. Not me. So, but when they said that, I thought, oh, yeah, you're right, actually. Like, that makes sense. So I got in touch with Radio 1 and said, I'm really interested in mental health. I'd like to cover the surgery whenever Gemma Kearney's off, who did it at the time. And to my shock and horror, they went, yeah, great, we'll get you in. And I like nearly fell off my seat because how many, you know, meetings do you have as a presenter that go nowhere? You'll know what it's like. And yeah. I felt like I just had a spate of knocking on doors that was shut in my face. And Radio 1 were like, yeah, sure, come in. And I was like, what?
Yeah. And so the whole curse of being a kids presenter must have been in your mind. What happens next? And then of all the places,
yeah,
Radio 1 said, yeah.
Do you know, I've never really worried about that as much as some of my sort of friends have. Yeah, I think it's only done me well that I was a kids' TV presenter. Yeah. I think people have only ever been interested in that. And if you look at like the best presenters on TV and radio now, like pretty much all of them have a kids' TV background. Yeah. And I'm obviously biased, but I'm like, those are the people to hire because we've had so much training of live TV with kids and animals and puppets and chaos. We can handle anything live. Like we're so hardened to it, and that's how I love live TV and live radio. I kind of hate it when stuff isn't live. I'm like, that's where's the thrill in that, you know?
Do you remember your first Radio 1 show?
Yes, I do, but I can't remember what the subject was, so I obviously don't remember it in enough detail because it was the surgery with Dr. Rada, and I don't remember the subject. But the surgery was a really good place to start because we only played 3 songs in the whole hour. And it was an hour of mostly chat with me, Dr. Rada, and sometimes someone else, another guest. And so technically it was very easy to do the buttons because you literally played 3 songs. So it felt like really good entry level. My boss, who's Ali Jones, who was the presenter of the surgery back in the day, is now my boss, was sort of he wasn't the boss at the time, but he was high up at Radio 1. Blummin came in and trained me on the desk and did my demo with me. And I was like, how intimidating is this? Yeah. This man's going to decide if I get the job or not. Plus, he used to present it. So it's his baby. And he's going to think, oh, well, you know, you're not doing it as good as I did.
But it luckily, went great.
Well, he gave me the job. Yeah. So, and then the surgery became Life Hacks, which is the show I do on Sundays now, you know.
And how much do you love that show?
Oh, I love it so much.
Do you?
I love it. Yeah. Again, I would just do it forever. I can't see, you know, I've done it for a long time now. So sometimes people are like, oh, you know, you're going to carry on doing that, you know? And I'm like, I can't see what would ever make me stop doing that.
Sundays.
Sunday roasts. Yeah, baby.
And you're Vic, obviously, your best mates.
Oh, yeah, she's the best. And so easy to work with. We just have it's just so easy. Every time we work together, we go, God, it's just so easy, isn't it? So easy. Like, and that makes it sound like it's also not fun or really great because it also is those things. But we just can, we know when the other's going to speak and we know what the other's going to say and we pick up after each other. And that's the best partnerships are like that. Some people you just click with us on air and some people you don't, and we do.
And you're dealing with a subject that's so close to your heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the same with Vic, you know, she has so much of that in her background. She's got so much knowledge about all these different issues that we cover. She cares. So yeah, we love that show.
When did you do your first show that wasn't an advice-based show?
So when it was the 50th anniversary of Radio 1, they got a few of us that were kind of waiting in the wings, wanting a little bit more. So it was me, Jordan North, Abby McCarthy and Yasser. They got us to do these special 50th anniversary shows. So that was the first time I did a show that was just music and shout outs and chat.
And how was that?
Oh my God, it was so good because the music was so good because it was music from the past 50 years. So it wasn't just the Radio 1 play. It was euphoric. I just remember being so happy to be doing that. And of course, I'd come from kids' TV. I wasn't just a presenter who did the serious stuff. I'd done years of entertainment and of the stupid stuff. So I knew that I wanted to do that. I wanted to have the silly chat as well as the serious chat. So, you know, from that moment on, I started to cover loads of shows on my own with Kel Spellman, who I was presenting with at the time, then with Vic. Now I cover loads with Vic and Jordan, and I just love it. I love it so much, Chris. Like, I never come away from Radio 1 and I've not had the best fucking day of my life. I always have a good day.
I see you in the studio and you always look like you're having the best time.
You've probably seen me have a few hangovers in there, though. That's the only thing with the weekend show. A few of them do get done with some pretty stinking hangovers.
Not everyone that comes from TV is comfortable doing the buttons, doing the faders, but I even get the sense that you love that bit.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the control. I actually hate not being in control of that. And when me and Vic and me and Jordan cover together, we alternate, you know, and I'm like restless because I am a fidgeter, to be fair. So I'm like, what am I going to do with my hands if I'm not driving the desk? So yeah, I love that. And I think you just, I think a lot of us as presenters are control freaks.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine being driven at all on the desk. What's been your best thing on Radio 1?
Oh, God. Oh, it's so hard.
You've done some big stuff already.
I mean, all the festivals, big weekend is always so good because you get all of us together in a room and it's fun. Do you know what? The last big weekend we did that, we have like 8 of us in the room, all the DJs, and we're coming and going and guests are coming. And it was the first time I sort of drove the desk at one of those.
Oh, was it?
And I felt really great that I was like, you know, respected enough at Radio 1 now to be in charge. I think every Radio 1 big weekend I've done, I've felt more a part of the family. And so, like, the first one, I was like, oh, like, I met Greg James at the first one that we'd never met before. And I just felt like I was this person just tagging along. And then as it went on and on and on, now I feel like I'm fully cemented one of those main Radio 1 DJs. And so that felt really good. Yeah, probably the festivals, but oh, we've done so much good stuff.
Yeah, you definitely do feel like part of the Radio 1 furniture now.
Yeah, it's really nice. Do you know what? Me and Jordan did a week of covering The Breakfast Show recently, and that was sort of the best week. So fun.
Why was it so fun?
We just did really stupid stuff. And I don't know, it just sort of... Jordan's so fun to work with. I love him to bits. And just loads of stupid stuff came up throughout that week. Like I said on air that someone texted in to say that their dog died and their mum lied and said it had gone to a farm. And I was like, no, but get this, mine actually did go to a farm.
I heard this.
Did you hear this? Yeah. So then we phoned up my mum and Jordan was like, Lorna, be honest, the dog did not go to a farm. And she was like, it did. We just like, it just felt like loads of silly stuff came up that week, probably because we were just so giddy. And also that Breakfast Show team are brilliant. Yeah. Like the team that Greg has there, like they're so smart. Yeah. And there's a bigger team, you know, this is the biggest show. So there's loads of them. So they're just on it and they've got great ideas. And yeah.
Since recording this conversation with Katie, she was announced as one of the new hosts of Going Home on Radio 1. So I caught up with her and asked her how she's feeling about her big new show.
I feel like I'm living in a simulation. I'm very excited. I feel like I'm in shock still. I was in shock for about 48 hours when I got the news and I wasn't expecting it. And now I am thrilled and very excited, but also terrified because I've got to move to London. And I love Manchester and I don't want to go. But yeah, very excited. DJ!
What about outside of radio, other stuff that you're doing at the moment?
I do quite a bit of BBC Morning Live. That's always fun. I think my only like TV goal that I've ever had is to do like a lifestyle magazine show,
yep.
Like a This Morning or a One Show or something like that. Because I think it's that interviewing people. I'm only really bothered about like interviewing people and chatting to people, really. So that's really fun. That's kind of my TV goal. But honestly, radio is... just so much better.
How do you think you're managing the pressure that comes with the job?
All right. I do struggle with it a little bit. Like, you know what it's like in our kind of world, like you just feel like you never know when it's going to end and you just fear for your job all the time and you fear for your livelihood and you think, what will I do if it ends? And I've actually just qualified as a counsellor. I've been trained to be a counsellor for the past 3.5 years. And the other night I was like in bed and I was like, that is so random. Why the hell have I trained to be a counsellor? Like, I'm not even intending to go into it as a job. Like, why did I do that? And part of it is that ambition we spoke about. Like, I think I've never let myself rest. I've always got to have a side project going on. But partly, like, in COVID, when everyone started to panic about their futures and what was going on, I only had the one show then on Radio 1. I was just doing Life Hacks. It was before I got my weekend Friday, Saturday show. And I was doing lots of cover and stuff. But I think I had a moment of, what if that all ends, you know? I need a backup plan. And also, because I do so much stuff in this mental health world, I often get asked for advice. Like, I get asked to come along and give advice. And I always feel a bit icky, like, oh, I don't have the qualifications to hold, you know, to back me up here. So those are the two reasons I sort of did that course, the pressure. So I think the thing I struggle with the most is the fear that it will all end, you know, and what I'll do then. And I think what I struggle with, and you might appreciate this too, is it feels like I had a meeting this week and someone basically sort of said, like, if you did Strictly, you'd probably get all these jobs. And they're completely right in saying that, like, that it wasn't a bad thing for them to say. But I think what I struggle with is, because I never set out to do this and I'm a very anxious person and I struggle with my mental health, I don't know if I would cope very well having that kind of profile that you get if you go on Strictly or you do I'm a Celeb.
I think you've already got that profile.
Not at that level, though. I think, you know, when at that level where you're sort of getting trolled and you're... I don't know if I would cope with that very well, but at the same time, you think in order to be attractive to the bosses that give you the jobs that you want, you got to do those things. So I think that's what I struggle with sometimes. Like,
what is the struggle for you? How does it manifest itself?
I think what I've learned now is rather than depression, it's real bad anxiety, because I tried this year to wean off my antidepressants and it went terribly. And I was off them for 4 months and it was the worst 4 months of my life. And I realized then that the problem was anxiety. It was worries. But I wish I knew what even the worries were. I just can't switch it off. It's a constant state of panic if I'm not on those tablets. And I had to go back on them. And I sometimes wonder, Chris, if I'm honest with you, if I would be like that if I'd not got into this job. You know, I sometimes think, and you know what? I think I've realised I maybe would. Because like I said, I had this anxiety as a kid. And I think I would have always been ambitious. And in whatever job I'd have got into, I would have kind of been ambitious and I would have worried about what would have happened with it. But I definitely think there's a lot that comes in with this world of presenting. You're pitted against each other all the time. You're in competition. People are saying things about you. You know, it's like in radio, there's like blogs where they talk about you all the time and there's, you know, stuff on Twitter and...
Which you have to ignore.
Which you have to ignore. And I am quite good at ignoring it. And actually, most people are really lovely about me. I don't get very many trolls at all, which is good. But I also think you can't take the good with the bad. Like sometimes I'll go and like read those blogs and they'll say really nice things about me. My husband will say, don't read them because one day they might hate you.
I'm
like, I know, but now it's a nice ego boost. And he's like, yes, but you can't take the good and ignore the bad. Like you've got to ignore all people's opinions of you, really.
I once very boldly, there was a post, a BBC post saying, who's your favourite presenter?
Yeah. And I hate that.
I wrote to the boss
good
of
for
the
you.
Social media and said, look, hang on, that's creating a competition.
It's not nice. If we did that behind the scenes.
Inviting negativity.
In any other job, if you went, who's your favourite in this team?
Yeah.
And like had everyone publicly say it, everyone would be like, this is mental. Yeah. It's that side of it. And you've got to really work, I think, at not letting it drive you insane.
Katie, for this series of How to DJ, we've teamed up with Flare Audio to ask our guests for their favourite song to listen to alone through earphones. So, Katie Thistleton, what is the track that you think is perfect for solo listening?
Oh my God. I am the biggest Swiftie. Big Swiftie. But I got into her late. So... everyone always thinks Taylor Swift is just, I don't know about you, I'm feeling 22, and all those songs, which are great, and great pop songs, and I am a pop girl, and I have loved and enjoyed all of that. But when she did her albums Folklore and Evermore in lockdown, I really got into Sad Girl Walks, and me and Vic used to talk about these Sad Girl Walks all the time that we would go on where we put our earphones in, and we'd listen to those albums, and we'd go walking around in the winter in the cold and think about all the breakups we hadn't had and all the terrible things that hadn't happened to us that Taylor Swift was singing about. And there's a song on that I listened to when I was coming off those antidepressants for about 4 months straight in the car on repeat. I literally, it finished, I started it again. It finished, I started it again. Because it was all I could listen to because happy songs really pissed me off and songs I couldn't relate to really pissed me off. And so I listened to that over and over again because every single line of it felt like exactly what I was going through. And it's called This Is Me Trying. And it's off that Folklore album. And it's about that. It's about somebody really struggling with their mental health and going, just so you know, this is me trying. This is as best as I can do right now. And I just listened to it constantly.
Katie, it's time for the first of your five picks from 45 in this record box here. All the questions are on 45 sleeves. You say when, I'll dip in.
They're on record sleeves. I never knew they were on sleeves. I've listened and I just thought they were little bits of paper coming out of a box.
Little sleeves, see that?
Oh, love that. Okay. I'll tell you when.
Yeah.
When?
How much do you prep?
How much do I prep? A decent amount, I think. We have like a little show meeting every week, me and my producer, Dom, who I do the Friday and Saturday show with. And we discuss like what stupid stuff we're going to do on the radio, basically. But then other than that, I just turn up like an hour before. I mean, it's great, isn't it? A radio shift. Lovely and cushy. On a Friday, I turn up early enough to do a little handover with Greg James, which is always one of my favourite bits of the week.
A lot of your stuff obviously is very targeted at the young people that are listening to you. So TikTok social media is a big part of the show, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, which is great because that's what a great job when like the thing you need to do is scroll TikTok and listen to music. Like,
I loved one that you
that's
did.
That's what I want to do anyway.
On a show a little while back, you were doing basically stuff that you've learned that you claim was from a documentary, a book you've read, but actually was from,
TikTok. Yeah, that's where we get all our information now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. And life hacks, like we have a team who does most of the prep for that, which is amazing. But I'm always sort of thinking of like, you know, what we want to do on there.
Because you grew up on television, Do you feel any pressure to deliver on social media?
Yeah, I do. But I've made my peace with the fact that I'm just not going to be making TikToks. Because I don't want to. And like, I like to watch them, but yeah. I don't want to make them. And I do post a fair bit on Instagram. I posted quite a lot on my Instagram stories about my life. I go through phases where I can't be asked and then phases where I'm in the mood for it. But I will often get told, like maybe by like my agent or maybe by commissioners and stuff, like, oh, put some more stuff, make some videos about this. And I get why that is really beneficial, because then you can send that to people and say, look what I do. And people have made really a lot of success off doing that. But I don't want to.
You're okay though with seeing yourself on screen, right?
On telly?
Either.
On phone stuff, fine, because you're in control of it. Love that. Love doing my own filming and my own selfies. Great. Hate watching myself back on TV.
Do you?
Hate. I very rarely do it. Very rarely watch back. And I want to watch back because I think that's how you learn to get better. Like, I listen back to most of my shows as well because I think that's how you learn what works and what doesn't. But I hate watching myself back on TV, so I try and avoid it.
Why do you think you hate watching
yourself? I'm just very insecure about how I look. I mean, I always have been, but I also put on like 3 stone when I went on the antidepressants. And I've never really accepted it. Not okay with it.
That's incredible that bothers you.
Oh, yeah, very, very, very much so. Like, I'm terrible with it. But I'm working on it.
Good. Back to the box for question 2. So when?
When?
What is the most famous you've ever felt, Katie?
That's a great question. What's the most famous I've ever felt? Oh. I mean, do you know what? Probably when I was on kids' TV.
Yeah.
Because you really get a lot of kids coming up to you. And I don't really get approached a lot now because people don't know what you look like when you're on the radio. And I still get people coming up to me that remember me from kids' telly, and I do get people who are real Radio 1 fans and they know you or they've seen me on Morning Live. But there was a time when I could not go near anywhere that would be full of kids. Yeah. It would be a nightmare. And I still get the anxiety now. So me and my husband were like going to a park recently and it's full of kids. And I was like, I felt it. And I was like, oh, it's fine. They won't know who I am. They don't know who I am because like that age now didn't watch me. They're all in their 20s now, the ones that watch me. So I meet them when I go and DJ at unis. The kids don't know who I am. But that back then, we went to the Rainforest Cafe once, just me and my husband on my birthday. Only people there that didn't have kids. And they found out it was my birthday and stood me on a chair and sang happy birthday to me. And then after that, there was just like a queue of children coming to have photos.
You know this, but I have a picture of you with my daughter in our downstairs loo when you did the CBBC Panto once. And you know what you've just described? I mean, you're like the Beatles when, you know, at the height of you guys, you know, coming off stage after that Panto and seeing the kids swarming around you.
Oh, it's so nice though. It's really nice. Like I miss that because I just think the kids' audience is, they're just lovely. You know, adults can be dicks, but kids aren't.
How long were you there for, did you say?
6 years.
So 6 years. So that it's a real generational thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And for parents as well. For me, I sat for, I guess that those 6 years that you were on were my daughter's time watching you. So yeah. I end up watching too.
And that happens even more with the CBBC presenters, because with CBBC presenters, you know, you can stick your kid in front of it and they're watching on their own, but the CBBC guys can't go anywhere because the parents watch them because they're sat with the babies, you know, and they, all the women fancy all the male presenters and, you know, you got all the mums coming over that fancy Andy Day and Benkirk G.
Yeah. But I watch you. I mean, that's when I first became a fan. And that holds out to now. Back into the box ball. Question 3.
When?
Question 3 is, what do you wish you'd never done?
Oh, just in general life or in career?
Let's do both. Life first.
What do I wish I'd never done? I wish I hadn't missed a weekend with my family to work once. I went, this is my only life regret because I don't believe in regrets because I think everything you've done has got you to where you are now and it was the right decision at the time. Don't believe in it. But I went and worked at Hay Festival, Children's Book Festival, for the weekend. And my family every now and again, my whole family, like my aunties and uncles and stuff. My mum's one of 9, so there's a lot of them. Like hire a big house somewhere and we do a fancy dress night. We spend a whole weekend together. And we hired a castle in Scotland and they all dressed up as Harry Potter characters. And I missed it and I regret it. Because looking back, doing that job wasn't as important as I thought it was at the time. But at the time, I wanted to do my own children's book, which I did then do. And so I thought it was really important. Career-wise, I don't have any regrets. I honestly don't, because I just think everything gets you where you are today. Like, I worked at Argos for 5 years. Great. Like, I just think every job I've ever done has led me to where I am, and it's all matters. There's a few jobs I've hated, but I don't regret them.
Argos is great, isn't it?
Love it.
I'm a big Argos fan. I've never worked in Argos.
It's a great place to work. It was like a youth club. We were all like 16 to 20. You know, we were all like just messing about, having a good time, going out together at the weekend.
How well did you know where stuff was?
Yeah, pretty well. You get to know after a while. And it's the most fun being in the back, because you just get to sort of mess about and chat and have a laugh and go and pick the stock. But always, like when you've been there a few years, you then get trained up on the till. And then when you've been there a long time, and I was there for 5 years, you're on customer services and the jewellery counter. And then you just got to deal with the customers, which is annoying because you just want to mess about with your friends in the back.
Back into the box. Question 4.
When?
Professionally, is there something that you'd love to do?
Professionally, is there something that I'd love to do? Okay, do you know what my ridiculous dream is? Because I realised recently that, you know, you can have a ridiculous dream. Would be to have my own talk show. That's my ridiculous dream that I don't think will ever happen. But if I could have a, you know, a Graham Norton or a Jonathan Ross, that's my dream. Because I just love interviewing people.
I think that will happen. It will.
That's my like ridiculous out there dream. That yeah.
Who would your dream guest be?
Taylor Swift.
Just Taylor Swift.
Yeah. In fact, it could just be a talk show just about her.
Every week.
Yeah. Beyonce. Yeah. Those people. My musical heroes.
One last question from the box.
When?
Have you ever had stage fright?
Yes. I mean, stage fright where you completely sort of clam up, or is that just like getting a bit nervous?
Where it's been crippling, where you weren't able to do what you were meant to be doing.
No, I've never not been able to do it, but I think I've had moments where I've gone, this sometimes happens, and even now, but it's anxiety. I'll just go, nope, I don't want to do it today. I don't want to do it. I don't want to leave the house. I don't want to talk to people. I don't want to. What am I doing? Why have I chosen a job where every day is like the day you have to give a presentation? No, I don't want to do it. I don't want to stand in front of people. I don't want to be looked at like every now and again. But then it goes as quick as it comes. Then I'm like, what are you on about? You're fine. You do this every day.
Does that make you a diva?
No, I don't think I ever say it to anyone. I just sort of deal with that internally. I think I always get really nervous before a new thing. So if it's like a new job that I've never done before, so first time I did Radio 1, first time I did Morning Live, you know. But then after you do it a while, I think those nerves just go. Like, and it's funny because a friend of mine used to always say, hey, when you stop getting nervous about something, it means you don't care anymore. I don't believe in that.
No, I don't.
At the time I was like, oh shit, I mustn't care. But I was like, no, I do care. I just think something becomes your norm and you adapt. So I do get stage fright before new things, but I just go out there and fake the confidence. Do you know what my tip is when it's like literally an onstage thing? Oh, I get really nervous about DJing. I mean, this whole podcast is about DJing. I get really nervous before a DJ gig. My tip is to go and like chat to some people on the front row or some people in the crowd, like, or if you meet some people on the way in, and then you just feel like you've already got some mates in there that are on your side. I used to do that when I would do things in front of kids' audiences. I would chat to some of the kids, be like, hey, and get to know them. And then I think, oh, there's people out there that are on my side.
I like that.
Yeah. Scarier than just standing and looking at this room full of people who you think want you to fail when they don't.
Do you like doing the DJing out?
I love it. Every time I do it, I'm buzzing afterwards. I'm like, brilliant. What can be better than choosing tunes for people and looking out and seeing them dancing? Like, what a thrill. But I'm always so nervous about it. But guess what I'm starting to do soon? And this has taken away all my nerves.
I know about this. I know.
Me and Hacker are teaming up. Genius. To do loads of DJ gigs. And I'm buzzing about that because I think it'll make me less nervous about performing. Because I feel awkward. Like, I love playing the tunes and I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But I'm not going to be like, way, like doing the move, like, hey, you know. So say there's DJs that I know that I'm really good friends with, like Ariel Free, amazing, love her to bits. She's like jumping around the stage like I don't know what. That's not me. I can't do that. I can't jump around the stage. So I'm always a bit nervous, like, what are they getting from me other than the tunes? But everyone always has a great time and it's always fine. So now I'm like, it's brill because Hacker can do all the silly messing about, have the selfies, be stupid, and I can, you know, do the music.
What's your best dance floor banger?
My favourite song of all time, which is my favourite song of all time that I won't play at my funeral, and it always goes down well, Pull the Disco 2000.
Yep.
Always great.
So do you like playing the indie hits?
I do like playing the indie hits because I think it's easier.
Tell me about it.
Because let's be honest, I'm not Calvin Harris, you know? Yeah. If I DJ dance, I feel like people are going to be like, you're not doing anything clever.
You're like, I need to be mixing this.
You can't mix indie, really.
Disco 2000 to Chelsea
just
Dagger.
Just bash it in, yeah. Just like you want something that starts with drums and ends with drums and it's everyone's having a good time. And you know what? Whenever I do a set where I do a bit of everything because it's a mixed crowd, it's always the one that goes down the best. And they always want Mr. Brightsize. And I'm like, fine. Like, I'm like, I'm not playing Mr. Brightsize. I'm not. And then you just see people with their phones and it says Mr. Brightsize. And you're like, fuck's sake, right? Here we go.
Yeah. Into Arctic Monkeys, dance floor.
Yeah. Exactly. Never fails.
Sex on Fire.
Exactly. Yeah. Never fails.
One last question for you, Katie. There's some kind of world-ending catastrophic event. You have to play the last three records on Earth.
No!
What would they be?
Oh, I've heard you do this question before and it is so hard.
You have to, I think, know that you could answer differently if I asked you this tomorrow or another time, you know.
Okay.
So it's just in this moment now.
Read it again.
It's the end of the world. You're playing the last three records on Earth to a global audience.
Oh, that's annoying because that's different to what I'd have for me.
No, it's not you in your bedroom. You're DJing.
Well, tough. Everyone else is going to have what I want. I'm trying to think. So obviously, yeah, Taylor Swift and Beyonce, my two favourite artists. I'm so basic like that. But what songs of theirs would be good for the end of the world? Beyonce actually has a song. It's not one of my favourite Beyonce songs, but it's called I Was Here. And it's literally about that. Leaving your mark. So maybe that would be a good one for everyone to reflect on the fact they were here and they've left their mark and none of it matters anyway because the world's imploding. I don't know if there are any Taylor Swift songs that are appropriate for the end of the world. Endgame? I'm just scrolling through my playlist now. Taylor Swift's got a great song called It's Time to Go.
Oh, that'll do.
And that's about knowing when to leave a relationship, leave a job. But, you know, maybe it will be time, won't it? When it's time to go, sometimes giving up is the strong thing. Sometimes to run is the brave thing. Sometimes walking out is the one thing that will find you the right thing. Sometimes giving up is the strong thing. Sometimes to run is the brave thing. Sometimes walking out is the one thing that will find you the right thing.
Was that three?
That's two. Three, I'm going to go Disco 2000 by Pulp. That's the one to go out on, you know, because I want that played at my funeral. So I feel like that, my general end of life song, whether I die and someone gets to play at my funeral or whether we all go together in a blaze of flames. And that's it. Let's all meet up in the year 2000. Won't it be strange when we're all fully grown? Be there 2 o'clock by the fountain down the road. Well, on that,
Katie Thistleton, thank you so much.
I don't know which I think is better.
And that was How to DJ.
How to DJ. How to DJ.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow us wherever you get your podcast from.